Hello, everybody. We are back. It is me, Thomas. I have returned from my very extended hiatus where I finally graduated from university. But Ideologic Obscura is back. We are on season two of Ideologic Obscura, and we are back, baby. And I mean this for real this time. No more, I'm going to leave and see you in 3 months or in 5 years. We are back. And to kick this off, we are going to be continuing with the cliffhanger that we left off in part one of Islamic Anarchism, where today we have on a very wonderful guest, someone that I have I've known based on our exchanges of academic work that we've done together, or like blog posting together on this one website called The Commoner. He's an amazing writer and theoretician. Please welcome Javier Cethnas.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for having me, Thomas.
Yeah. So, Javier, one of the... and today we're going to be talking about the second part of Islamic Anarchism, in which mainly we focus on modern iterations of Islamic Anarchism, which is particularly focused on by this one guy named Muhammad Abduh. And Javier... with us today in the studio, or in the virtual studio, has written about Abduh's work and has commented on him, and so I consider him an expert of sorts. So, Javier, first off, how you doing today otherwise?
Doing fine. Thanks so much, Thomas. You know, it's a little bit cloudy today, so less heat, calm morning, and I'm here looking forward to this discussion.
Tell us first off about this book that that Muhammad Abduh wrote, which is actually based off of his PhD thesis in Vancouver. I think it was in Vancouver, the university he went to.
So this book is called Islam and Anarchism. It was published last year by Pluto. And it has it's basically it applies different theoretical frameworks for understanding and elucidating what Abduh calls anarcho-Islam. And so he really emphasizes anti-racist, BIPOC, abolitionist politics in his elucidation of anarcho-Islam. He also integrates what we might call post-left anarchism, or an anarchism that is influenced by post-structuralist ideologies and post-modernist ideologies. Definitely also...
What is that exactly?
Sure.
Sorry to interrupt, but what is that exactly? The post-anarchism. I think some viewers may not know what the post-structuralism about it is.
Of course, thanks for that. Yeah, so in anarchism and in anarchist history, we can distinguish different tendencies and groups. So we have the classical anarchists, who are typically, you know, Bakunin, Proudhon, Kropotkin, who have different, you know, different tendencies or different views, but more or less the same, especially if you think about Bakunin and Kropotkin. And then, of course, there are more individualist tendencies that have more to do with Max Stirner or maybe Friedrich Nietzsche a little bit, that were involved in kind of insurrectionist politics and maybe like expropriations, especially in France. And then later in the 20th century, toward the end of the 20th century, there were some developments philosophically coming out, especially of France. Both post-structuralist and post-modernist ideologies that kind of critiqued the classical revolutionary Marxist leftist anarchist idea of changing the world for a much more, I would say, nihilist and kind of localist approach that kind of is very critical of those, as they call, grand narratives of, again, anarchism, Marxism, revolution, progress, enlightenment, and so on. So these kinds of thoughts definitely are integrated into Abduh's account, and they come together with what we call, or what is called, post-colonialism, which is similarly kind of applying post-structuralist philosophies to the conditions of the so-called third world in its post-colonial historical context, that is, once the various empires have been overthrown.
I see. Yes, and this, and basically, and we'll be getting been talking about plenty of that post-colonial societies. He basically argues with that is that the premise that colonialism never ended in settler colonial societies, such as the United States and Canada, where the settler colonial state still is colonizing and oppressing people of BIPOC groups, and particularly indigenous people, and also in societies that have inherited it, such as Egypt, which has inherited the capitalist state model, and I would guess other societies that have inherited the mantle of colonial power, such as India or Pakistan. And that's based on what he even says with the post-colonialism.
Absolutely, and that kind of thought is very much influenced by Frantz Fanon, the Martinican psychiatrist who fought with the FLN in the Algerian Revolution against French colonialism. And definitely, Fanon made a very good point about how the colonial structures and institutions, bureaucracies, were perpetuated, or there was a large risk that they would be perpetuated in the post-colonial state. And definitely, as you were mentioning, there are many examples of this, unfortunately.
Yes. And as Abdu outlines this, one would come to the conclusion that Muslims are oppressed by capitalism, but they no longer are backing or supporting anti-capitalist movements, but instead he argues that Muslims have been struggling with an exponentially growing identity crisis, which has led to two reactionary responses. The first one being neo-fundamentalism, reenacting their colonially internalized trauma by conducting violence, and two, reenacting the projects of self-orientalization. This also includes diasporic Muslims in the West who try to become law-abiding citizens. And this is pretty poignant from his argument in the Age of Terror in the post 9/11 world, which only happened a couple of days ago, about 22 years ago.
Oh yes, absolutely. And so Abdu does set up this dichotomy, right, between the neo-fundamentalist and neo-orientalist approaches. And I think that that's actually a very, very insightful contribution that he makes in this work. The only thing I might critique him on this is that if you look at the Orientalist theoretical elucidation that Edward Said promotes in his, of course, classic Orientalism, there have been some actual apt critiques of that, especially from Marxists. There's a Lebanese Marxist whose name I am forgetting, not Gilbert Achkar, but mentioned in Gilbert Achkar's book on this question, namely that the kind of the focus on Orientalism can either intentionally or not give way to kind of an Occidentalist reaction, which is kind of uncritical of authoritarian dynamics in post-colonial societies. We can think, most prominently of the Islamic Republic of Iran or even the Taliban in Afghanistan now. There was a very good article that I just read on Jed Aliyah about how cultural relativism can kind of overlook the very serious struggles that, women and children are having in both of those countries. And of course, this can and often has been tragically manipulated and mobilized by U.S. imperialism, especially the George W. Bush administration, as we know, invading Afghanistan, overthrowing the Taliban, and Barbara Bush, kind of focusing on an imperial feminism that unfortunately, I think, lets women and children's struggles be lost in the mix, because it becomes difficult for leftists, especially with an anti-imperialist politics, to express care for these very vulnerable groups, which we can't actually forget about.
Yes, no, you're absolutely right on that. And I particularly, you brought up a point about the culture relativism, and I think that is a very poignant part of that, in which there is a problem, at least on the left, from what I've understood of this, of aspects of culture relativism, in which we are supposed to ascribe a different moralities towards people because of their different culture. And that sometimes makes people beyond critique in that case, if we were to use an anti-colonialist model. However, this often gives cover for some of the problems that we will also see later in Abdu's book.
For sure, yeah, no doubt about it. And I think that it also applies to similar cases like Bashar al-Assad, the dictator of Syria, who in his interview on the book with Coffee with Comrades kind of explicitly came out in favor of him. It was really mind-blowing. And if we think about today's actually the anniversary of the death of Mahsa Amini in Iran, the Kurdish young woman who was killed by the morality police for rejecting hijab or forcible hijab.
Yeah, I remember that.
And right. And so Abdu's response also on the Coffee with Comrades podcast, it was very short and brief, but what was talking about the mobilization, quote, of gendered Islamophobia. So this, I think there is something to this, unfortunately.
No, you were correct on that. But moving forward, because I do want to touch on more about this problem on your in your article. So if Muslims are subjects are victims of neocolonial global capitalism, both from foreign Western countries and also from their own states as well, they are subject to reactionary fundamentalist regimes in which there is an alliance between the ulema, the clerical class of Islam, and the state, and also they have their own inverted Orientalist, self-orientalizing projects properly in order to supposedly integrate into Western societies. What is the solution that Abdu proposes in order to break out of this?
Well, as far as I recall, I think that Abdu suggests a kind of an inspiration, going back to the original state of Islam, looking back to the venerable ancestors, al-Salaf, al-Salih. And he also proposes, as I was mentioning before, kind of in the spirit of post-anarchism, kind of an insurrectional politics, as well as the use of anarchic jihad, which is kind of independent or autonomous judgment or reasoning, which seems like a good plan to me, among others. I'm sorry if I'm forgetting the strategic details that he proposes, but those are the things that I can recall.
Yes, no, I think you hit on the key ones. For those who may not know, the previous version of the as you said about, like, with this going back to tradition, and this is something that we covered in the first part of Islamic anarchism, there is somewhat of an idealized view of the beginning of Islam as a almost anarchic state in which you had a borderless community, the ummah, and also you had minimal state interference in religion and state and religious interference in people's lives, but instead it was a form of unity, almost a communalist force of people, and that is kind of the return to tradition aspect of Islamic anarchism, in which they seek to basically recreate this imagined country, that was a collectivist ummah that was actually based on the theory of Weil Halleck, who wrote The Impossible State, in which he did say that there was no Islamic state, and that in pre-modern times, only varying confederate and decentralized forms of Muslim governance. So that is, from what you and I have read, is the main thesis of Abdu, that you want to return to the medieval pre-caliphate state, and that would be a solution for Muslims as an anarchist one. If that deals with the state question, and if that deals with the issue of a hierarchy, how do you deal with the issue of reactionary fundamentalism? Because I feel like he doesn't properly deal with this question, but what would you think?
Absolutely, and I think that you did a good summary there. I mean, if you look, this tradition is called Salafi. Salafi Islam, I mean, has other terms, but one of them can be called Salafist, and also jihadist Salafist. And this is the thing, because if you look at the Taliban specifically, and not only them, but many groups in Syria, unfortunately, that have survived the horrible civil war and international war that has been going on there, they espouse these kinds of politics, which are very, very hardline right, extreme right, chauvinist, ultraviolent politics. So yeah, and that's one of my concerns about Abdu's book, is that he kind of does, he's not totally unsympathetic, or he's not totally critical, maybe in a sense because he doesn't want to go in on his fellow Muslims too much. But I think that, you know, if you look at his analysis of Sayyid Qutb, who was kind of the Salafi jihadist theorist of the 20th century, who was executed by Nasser in Egypt, and who has inspired not only Al-Qaeda, but Daesh, the Islamic State. And if you also look at some of his comments about Mohammed Atta, one of the terrorist hijackers from 9/11, I'm just saying, I don't really see too much of an honest critique there. So, which is not to say that, you know, Abdu necessarily sympathized with these politics, but I don't see him coming out too strongly against that. And I just repeat that, you know, the Taliban and other Salafi jihadist groups want to go back to the origins. And so it's kind of similar in that sense to Christianity, because a lot of the fundamentalist Christians also similarly, quote unquote, want to go back to the origins, but so do on the other hand, Christian anarchists similarly want to go back to what they call the original community. So I guess it depends which original community do they mean? Was it real? Also, you know, historically speaking, you have to think about which year or period, because there was the so-called Golden Age, and then there was, you know, increasing despotism and state oppression coming up later.
Yeah, and as you outlined in the other article where you talked about Crewe's thesis, the decline thesis, in which he explained, that's a whole nother state, but it basically you were talking about that the previous anti-authoritarianism that existed in Islam was against the current fundamentalist model of the ulema, also known as the clerical class, state alliance, which that alliance actually led to the underdevelopment and the decline of the Islamic world, according to Kuru, and that anti-authoritarianism existed prior. And so so he's trying to get to that anti-authoritarianism, one that was embodied by the Mu'tazilites or the Qadirites. But I keep seeing a failing, like as you said, with how he's also in the same, theoretically in the same position as the Salafis. He says that, oh, we are progressive, we have all of these, we want to support BIPOC people and individuals, but I just keep coming back to it, that how does he, how is he actually going to square that by actually promoting a progressive politics? Because how do you clamp down on the more fundamentalist aspects of Islam? Particularly if you're in a more anarchistic state, how are you going to make sure that the community is not going to adopt this kind of ultra conservative beliefs?
Oh yeah, I mean that's a great paradox. I know Murray Bookchin talks about that in a different context, in the sense of, like, you know, if we ever get to an anarchist society in the future, and there are, you know, human rights violations, oppression, violence against minorities in a given anarchist group, how then should the other anarchists respond? And I think he does talk about something about, like, anarchist peacekeepers or something, some kind of anarchist military intervention, which would not be inconsistent with anarchist history. If you think about, you know, the Spanish Revolution, you think about the direct action, not only in labor organizing, but also in insurrections and assassinations and so on. So, I mean, yeah, to your question specifically, it would be very hard. I mean, if we think about, you know, a realistic future going forward, I mean, with the power of Saudi Arabia and Qatar, the Emirates, you know, very oppressive and entrenched and extremely ultra wealthy groups that have, it's not a surprise, unfortunately, that Wahhabism and Hanbalism and kind of a very reactionary fundamentalist Islam has spread throughout the Muslim world in the last, 30, 40 years due to this dynamic, not only, of course, due to the power of Saudi Arabia and so on, but also due to the decline of the left, we can say, and definitely also the imperialist interventions of Bush and Obama and Clinton and so on.
Yeah. And yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's the key issue. I mean, the only thing I can think of, just going over my notes again, would be respect for it jihad, but I think that only goes so far. You can have independent judgment and thought, but you can't get other, but it's not like you can force upon everyone else to think as independently as you and then come to the same conclusion. Because I mean, if everyone, it's basically it's one assumption that I think that a lot of leftists fall into is that once we arrive into a post-capitalist society or an anti-capitalist society, everyone will be, you know, as progressive as me, but that's not going to be the case. I mean, that's just a blatant assumption. And I think that is a conceptual trap that a lot of people unfortunately fall into. But moving from one conceptual trap to another, I want to ask you about more on what we touched about earlier. As he said, he has not critiqued the more oppressive and colonial states, not only just of Assad, but also of like other states such as Iran and Russia. And particularly, I think that this is a common problem along the left as well. And I just want to let you ask you some to elaborate more on this as well.
Oh, absolutely. And thanks for that. Yeah, I mean, that's the phenomenon of pseudo anti-imperialism as developed by Rohini Hensman, who wrote a book on Haymarket books called Indefensible. That's a history of the modern world in terms of atrocities being carried out by different states with the support more or less of the left in the name of quote unquote anti-imperialism. But she very much shows that you know, in the case of Russia, especially, but not only Russia, also Iran, if you think about what Iran does in Lebanon, in Syria, in Palestine, and also, you know, in Yemen. I mean, it is, we can maybe say, a sub-imperialist power, but definitely it has some imperialist desires and interventions. Yeah. Even. But certainly
power like Turkey.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, and it has a major rivalry with Saudi Arabia, which you know, itself, I don't know if we can call it imperialist, but certainly is a very wealthy and despotic country. But yes, I think that this is a very big problem on the left, and it certainly has resonated in the last year and a half, you know, with the massive invasion of Ukraine by Russia. You know, in the run-up to it, many leftists, Western leftists, even Ukrainian leftists, and anarchists were in denial that it would happen. It did happen, of course. And, you know, to date, many Western anarchists and leftists, not all, of course, there are some exceptions, but many have just kind of ignored what's been going on there, the atrocities that are daily there, in the name of, you know, quote unquote, again, anti-imperialism, because they don't want to be seen as being on the side of NATO, which is supporting Ukraine, even though it's not directly involved. And I think that it's really, unfortunately, it's very tragic, but it is a recurring problem on the left.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think we're both on Twitter ourselves. Our listeners, knowing that they listen to this podcast, are also probably on Twitter as well. But I think we...
Looks like you're muted.
Oh, crap. Oh, sorry.
Sorry.
I was the most insightful dialogue of the of the century, but I'm muted.
You were saying people are on Twitter. That's the last thing I heard.
The app knows it intentionally. Like, oh, he's talking about Twitter. I don't hear any of that shit.
Sorry.
That's all right. Hold on. I'm just trying to find my notes where I talked about it. Aha, bingo. Abdu falls into this problem as well. And I think, and as, you know, we're both on Twitter, we see this every day. You know, you hop on, you immediately are seeing someone with like a hammer and sickle in their avatar photo, basically saying like, oh, China's going to bring the end of Western capitalism through the helping Russia in the war in Ukraine or something.
Right. Or North Korea.
And or North Korea is going to do that. That's just in the news right now. I think the problem with people like this is that politics, and I think it's for everything, politics and particularly geopolitics is seen as almost like a team sport. It is either you're on team blue or you're on team red. There's no in between. There's no nuance. There's no complexity. You can't go turn around and say, oh, I hate American imperialism. And then because of that, according to this logic, you then can't turn around and say, well, what Russia is doing is a war crime and an atrocity and imperialism. No, you have to twist yourself into some kind of Ouroboros and basically start arguing that, oh, Russia is actually an anti-imperialist power by doing imperialism on the people. Yeah, they're waging war on NATO and the West, not on average Ukrainians that are working in factories or working in shops or the increasing wartime conditions on Russians themselves. And I mean, you know, you can find this these people from either their to anarchists credit, I think anarchists are a lot more nuanced in their politics, in their particularly in geopolitics, because they by themselves they don't attach themselves to a particular team, because that's the whole point. But I think other leftists, particularly like socialists, communists, they will attach themselves to these non-American, basically the non-American countries, Russia, Syria, China, Iran, and basically say that these guys are, anti-imperialists. These guys go from being reactionary types of quote-unquote leftists, such as the MAGA communists. That's a phrase that gives me a stroke every time I think about it.
Oh my God.
So I think that is a really big problem, and I think falls into this because he's so obviously, I mean, there's plenty of reason why he would be against American imperialism and against American geopolitics and geopolitical strategy. But I think that's the trap that he falls into. And then that's when he turns around both in the book and on that podcast, where he then says, oh, Assad is actually an anti-imperialist force, and that we actually need to support these horrible authoritarian conservative regimes in order to achieve our post-capitalist progressive utopia. I think that he's just fallen into that intellectual trap of there.
Oh, absolutely. And that has a long pedigree, you know, goes back to the Comintern, right? The Soviet Comintern run by Stalin, suppressing the Spanish Revolution and killing Polish communists and collaborating with the Nazis and so on, right? And of course, there was that huge phenomenon historically of denialism that even we see it today, denialism of the barbaric depths of Stalin's depravities in the Gulag and the Holodomor in Ukraine and so on. And not only that, clearly, yeah, in the case of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, just kind of total denialism, don't think about it, it never happened, but millions of Afghans were killed during that invasion and occupation, and that just kind of, you know, goes away, melts away in the historical consciousness. So, I mean, for sure. And I also wanted to say that, that there's also the post-leftist anarchism and the post-structuralist and the post-modernism that also has played a nefarious role. I think it's been a nasty stream in this whole confluence. Because if you think about Foucault, actually Kevin Anderson and his wife wrote an interesting book analyzing how Foucault, who was very much an enthusiast of Khomeini, who took over the Iranian Revolution much to the worse for everyone, how Foucault was enamored by Khomeini and, you know, considered him as, you know, some anti-Western, anti-imperialist, like, sage that was going to bring Iran into, you know, or not bring Iran into the modern age. That wouldn't be his aim, but rather, you know, to restore traditionalism and so on, which would be, it's kind of very paradoxical for someone who is, like Foucault, supposed to be a progressive, anti-carceral thinker.
Yeah, how else can be like, holy cow.
Right.
That's insane.
But it's very similar to kind of what Abdu is suggesting there, as you're saying, with the team sports. And it's basically, theoretically, it's called campism.
Yeah.
It goes back to the Cold War, whereby, you know, the so-called tankies would uncritically support, as you were saying, you know, the Soviet Union, China, or their modern day equivalents now, which of course are Putin's Russia and Xi's China. But it very much contradicts the anarchist spirit of internationalism, which is all about class struggle. It's about the proletariat. It's about human self-emancipation across borders without any concern for these arbitrary lines that are set up by the state. And it's based in direct action in our common humanity. That's what anarcho-collectivism and communism are all about. So that's, I would say, very concerning, but also not necessarily consistent with anarchism. And I'm actually, one last thing I want to say here is that started reading The Anarchist Inquisition by Mark Bray, where he talks about how there was a human rights and humanitarian campaign internationally in the wake of the execution by the Spanish state of Francisco Ferrer, the rationalist educator, in Barcelona. And so that this movement across borders in a certain way was consistent with human rights. So it was kind of an interesting intersection between anarchism and human rights that we sometimes don't hear about. And indeed, unfortunately, in Abdu's book, we see them as kind of two opposite poles.
No, absolutely. And also just the thing that still boggles my mind is that because of how entrenched that Cold War campism is, that you have people that were born way after the Cold War, probably even way after 9/11, who fall into the exact same camps of supporting Russia and China as anti-imperialist countries against America, even though these countries have completely abandoned any type of socialist or communist plan. I mean, China nominally says, "Oh, this is part of the goal of socialism with Chinese characteristics." But yeah, no, they're bullshitting to you when they still use all this pageantry and whatnot. And the same thing with Russia. Russia doesn't even try to hide it. The only time that they ever utilize iconography or hark back to the Soviet Union is in order to. It's almost as if reminiscing of a time of when Russia, the nation, was itself a strong country. It's not about the ideals of communism or socialism or Marxism. It's about the idea of a Russia as a strong country, one that could stand toe-to-toe with the United States and had a large portion of the world under its influence. Leftists in the West and supposed the so-called leftists and other and naive leftists in the West look at that and say, like, oh, Russia is actually supportive of America. And also, like, when they Putin says, oh, we're anti-imperialist, we're against American imperialism, both in Europe and Ukraine and also in ECOWAS, they take it at face value as well. And because of that campism, it's unfortunate that leftism is very much stuck in this binary mindset, this very binary Cold War mindset, even though it no longer reflects the world that way.
Well, absolutely. No, for sure. And I think there is a great deal of naivete about Russia in particular on the Western left, even among anarchists. You know, I mean, there's just, again, I mentioned some of the atrocities earlier, but even in Tsarist Russia, the imperialist attack on the Circassians, or the Adygay people. I mean, it nearly annihilated them. It was a very, very, very substantial genocide. And that's kind of just written out of the history books for leftists in this kind of denialist, collective, unconscious reaction, which, again, I repeat, is naive. But I think if you think about it, I think, I mean, we need history to help us illuminate this problem, this phenomenon of pseudo anti-imperialism and campism. But we also can, I think we can also benefit from psychoanalysis, because if you look at Freud, I mean, he talks about how the boy, you know, the prototypical boy growing up rebels against his father, but then kind of later just basically reproduces his father. Yeah. So, you know, just in brief. And I think that that's kind of very much what's going on here with this kind of thought that, oh, well, you know, the US is so bad, Russia is so good, or actually, I'm not going to comment on all the bad things that Russia's doing and has been doing for centuries. I'm just going to blot that out and just have this kind of naive and misinformed approach, a historical approach that has nothing to do with internationalism, and indeed, in many cases, straight up contradicts internationalism.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, and I think we need to break out of that. And so, I not to put you too much on the spot, but because you proposed an alternative, so if there is a way, not only for, I mean, we're no longer speaking specifically about the Muslim world or Islamic anarchism anymore, but a wider problem. Because, I mean, that's how, this is, welcome to the Ideological Obscura podcast, where we diverge onto various different things. But you when you were talking about in your second article, where you, both of these articles will be in the link in the description. When you talked about in your second article with Kuru, where he talked about the decline thesis of the state ulema authoritarianism basically caused the decline of the Islamic world and this historical institution that has kept enduring and has continued to underdevelop the Muslim world alongside external factors such as imperialism and invasion. If Islamic anarchism itself is not a solution and is not one that is not going to help us achieve a progressive and anti-capitalist world, and is more specifically a platform for Muslims, it may not actually even help Muslims who are more progressive or want to have a similar vision, because it would continue a very reactionary culture that isn't properly dealt with in the thesis. What did you say about your thesis of anarcho-communism as a potential answer to this?
Sure, let me get to that in a moment, but I do want to just say, although we haven't really talked about the Mu'tazilites, we mentioned them in passing, the Harijites. I mean, I did a little bit of study of the Mu'tazilites during the research for my first article, the review of Abdu's book, and I really want to plug them as an alternative version or vision of Islamic anarchism that I could really definitely sympathize with.
Sure.
Go
ahead. I was just going to say that we covered them in the previous episode, but I would absolutely love to hear what you have to say.
No, nothing more really to say, just that, you know, I really like what I saw, and not only them, but also Ibn Rushd, and also many of the thinkers that Kuru discusses in his very excellent historical volume, from the dating back to the golden age, so-called, of Islam. I would very much sympathize with many of those thinkers as well, but so to your point, or to your question, I think that, you know, anarcho-communism is a viable alternative, maybe not a viable alternative, but it's a theoretical alternative that is that could come out of, you know, or could converge with many different movements that we've seen actually in the Middle East and North Africa, especially the Syrian Revolution and the Rojava Revolution in particular. If you look at the Syrian Revolution, and it's, again, unfortunate Abdu doesn't go into this at all, but, you know, one of the main activists or organizers was Omar Aziz, who was a Syrian anarchist who helped to push the revolution forward, theorized the use of Tanzikiyat, or the LCCs, the local coordinating committees, that were a democratic and even anarchic form of self-governance against the regime in liberated areas. And so that, you know, that had a lot to do also with, or very similar to, the communes in Rojava, which is not to apologize for the PYD, the political leadership of the Rojava Revolution, and the SDF, the Syrian Democratic Forces, who have been accused of many unfortunate things. That's despite their direct opposition to Daesh. So I think that, you know, I think the support for movements like that, revolts, that we've seen in Iran, particularly, again, as I mentioned earlier, a year ago after the murder of Mahsa Amini in the streets, another great popular revolution, or not necessarily a revolution, but an uprising. And we've seen it recently in Suweida, which is a Druze minority community in Syria, that has kind of in recent weeks been going back to the ritual, the political ritual of coming out to the streets and actually demonstrating against the regime as it began during the so-called Arab Spring uprising, so 2011. So I think that certainly, you know, supporting those kinds of movements, also supporting groups like Asr Anarchism, which is an Iranian and Afghan anarchist group that we interviewed on The Commoner recently in a two-part interview.
I had to go check it out.
And also, for sure, I think, you know, supporting these kinds of groups, supporting feminist groups, supporting youth groups, supporting, you know, I mean, providing support, I think, is really just the way that we can move forward toward an anarcho-communist horizon, which would consist of, you know, directly democratic control of production, workers' control, anti-authoritarian politics, the destruction of the state, the return of power to communities and to the working class. I think that these are elements that could definitely help us in our struggle against Islamic despotism, and not only, of course, Islamic despotism, but authoritarianism throughout the world, in the United States, Russia, China, and throughout.
Really. Internationally. That's the whole name of the game, internationalism.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so Javier, I think we're near the end of the episode, and I just wanted to ask if you would like to plug your stuff.
Sure. Thanks so much. I really appreciate this conversation. And, you know, I'm always interested in talking about these kinds of things, history, politics, current events. So I'm an editor at The Commoner. So check out The Commoner, thecommoner.org.uk, if I'm recalling correctly.
I've also posted on there, so I can recommend it as well.
Yes, I do appreciate your discussion of Cyberpunk, which inspired my own review of it.
Yeah, thank you.
No problem. My most recent book is Queer Tolstoy, a psychobiography, which is a psychobiography of Count Lev Tolstoy, and his art and his life, kind of a queer reinterpretation of it. I'm working on the second part of it now, which focuses on Anna Karenina and the Kreutzer Sonata and his later life, where he kind of becomes more openly and prophetically a Christian anarchist, but paradoxically at the same time very much espouses misogynist views. So it's kind of a Proudhonian contradiction. Beyond that, I have some previous works that I've written about global warming, about Herbert Marcuse. All of these can be found on my website, which is intlibecosoc, intlibecosoc.wordpress.com.
Nice. Well, thank you so much, Javier. I really appreciate you coming on the show, and I look forward to having you on more episodes. But thank you again for tuning in to Ideologica Obscura. We're now season 2. We're going on it. We're doing it. It's real this time. I know I said this before in the past, but hey, shit happens. Life happens. But I'm over all that stuff. I've finally graduated. So I'm going to have more time in order to do this stuff. But thank you so much again, Javier. And to everyone, this has been Ideologica Obscura. See you around next time. Bye-bye.